Thank you to our sponsor, Austin Jaro, for sponsoring episode 28 of the Duluth Rundown. In part one of our podcast, we talked about gearing up for winter, some kind of cold weather gear, and also lights and things that you may need for when it starts getting a bit darker. And just a reminder that you can get all that stuff plus anything else running related, whether it be shoes, socks, food, and above all, expertise, go to Austin Jaro. They're right here in Duluth up by the mall. 917 West Central Entrance is the address. Again, that is 917 West Central Entrance here in Duluth. Go visit Austin Jaro.
All right, and we are joined with our in the interview section with Barb Kernow from kind of a longtime member of the Duluth running community, been involved in many different things, worn a lot of different hats in the running world, in the trail world specifically. So Barb, thank you for joining us on the Duluth Rundown.
Well, thank you.
Well, let's get started with kind of where it all began. Give us a time frame of maybe some dates what got you started.
Jean walked down to watch grandma's. We were both 40. It was 84. And then he decided he wanted to run it. So 2 years later, he was ready to run. The kids were all in track at school, and they used to kind of laugh at him because he had weak ankles, and he'd come back covered in leaves, and they'd always ask him to blow another tennis shoe. And, of course, he ran Grandma's, and I think he did Twin Cities that year and did quite well. I think it was like a 3:10, which was his PR. Then he got involved with the NMTC running and, of course, heard about Voyager, so he had to try that, and he never did get a faster marathon because he was running long all the time.
Sure, yeah.
And he dragged me behind him. I was his volunteer.
And did you run any of the races yourself?
No, I don't run, but I started walking, and of course we did every small race around, sometimes three a weekend, and some of them started having walking divisions, so he told me to do that. And a few years later I thought, could I do a marathon? And there was a very loosely organized one out in the Black Hills that Larry Simonson put on, and it was a 50 mile and a marathon. So of course Gene did the 50 mile, and it started at 3, but it started in Rapid City, went up to the start of the marathon and came back. So he dropped me off marathon distance from Rapid City and said, go, it's pitch black.
Oh God.
That's how I did my first marathon.
Nice.
At 3 a.m., that is, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of
it was supposed to be all downhill, but there was a good 4 mile section that had just a little slope up, but it wasn't a bad marathon. And that let me take as long as I needed, so that was okay.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we got involved. Well, Gene did the Ed Fitz 3 years, and the next year he did a 20-mile leg, and I ended up coordinating the aid stations, which was a nightmare. And it was the World Cup, so they had some fantastic runners. Giannis Kuros was either third or fourth, and Gary Cantrell, who wrote for Ultra Running, and is a very funny man, mentioned that the guy in front of him turned around and knew he wasn't going to slow down. he held world records for everything from 100 miles and on.
So that's pretty cool to see some of those world-class ultra runners.
Oh, yes. Yes, fantastic.
What aid station was that?
I coordinated all the aid stations.
Oh.
And I had a contact in the cities, and he would call and say, we need this, this, and this. And I'd set it up with, because I was just starting to race direct Voyager, I'd set it up with my suppliers. Then he'd call back, no, we found that, so never mind. So I got to call my supplier. It was a nightmare. I think I started working on it at noon on Thursday. We met Dave and his wife down at the deck. Mm-hmm. And we finished up at noon on Sunday by cleaning up all the stuff out there. I got 2 hours sleep maybe every night.
Yeah.
It sounds like working an ultra marathon. Get about 2 hours of sleep.
Yeah. I told Gene, you're doing Chicago next year because I'm not working on that thing again. Then he ended up signing us up to work the finish line a few years later. The same guy that stuck me with the Voyager was in charge of the finish line before that.
Let's talk a little bit about the Edmund Fitzgerald. I think that's a race that, I mean, was a huge race here in this area. Obviously, you know, getting world-class people. That's a race I think some folks are starting to forget about now, or maybe a lot of people don't even know about it, but that was a big, big deal.
It was.
Let's talk about where the race started and where it finished and, like, what was the route?
Okay, at the time Gene ran it, they started in Little Moray, and they had to stay on the lakeside, so the lean was always the same for 100K. And they finished at the halfway up Lemon Drop Hill the first few years. And then when they built the big tunnels, they started running on the back roads to get down and finished at Brighton Beach. And Gene ran it solo 3 years.
like ran it as a participant or racer? Okay.
Yeah, he ran the 100K. And second 2 years, I biked on the other side of the road as crew. So.
That's interesting. So the aid stations, you managed the aid stations, they were just on, like, kind of road, the wayside rests, or?
Yeah, well, that was the year that they started putting it on the back road, so it was up on some gravel roads and then came down into two harbors. But, yeah, it was every 5K, so.
Wow. That's a lot of aid stations for 62 miles.
Yes, it was. I remember going up, there was it was called Bay to Bay, and it was a 5 mile from Silver Bay to Beaver Bay. And one of our NMDC runners, who had kind of a whiny voice, is saying, "Well, where's the aid station?" The guy took one look at her and said, "This isn't the Ed Fitz. We don't have one. It's only 5 miles."
It's kind of weird that the road ultras, it's almost like, not to mention just the Edmund Fitzgerald and the Duluth World, is kind of, you know, new runners like myself, I've only heard about it in kind of folklore almost, and even the whole sport of, you know, road ultras seems to be kind of fading out as more and more trail runs, you know, become popular.
There's still a few, I'd say. There's I like the 20, all the different hourly ones up in New York City and things like that. And I'm sure they don't do the Transamerica anymore, but it started at Huntington Beach, California, and ran to Central Park in New York.
Yeah.
They were on the freeways in, dear Gene did Western States. We were coming back, and he wanted to see where the guys were. So we're in, I think it was Utah, and it was hotter than blazes. They had to run the freeway because there weren't any roads.
Yeah.
And we go down into this valley where it's about 10 degrees hotter anywhere else, and there they are slogging along. Oh,
wow.
Really sad.
So, Barb, you've talked about Gene, and I think Tony and I know who you're talking about, but our listeners might not know. who Gene is, and then I think once you explain, they may put two and two together, because of course there is a race now in Duluth that is in the past couple of years, believe it or not, I believe it's the third largest marathon in Minnesota.
Oh, really? We started with 40 some people. the year I took over Voyager, Gene, my husband, Gene Colonel, took a group out 3 weeks before, because the trail is only marked the night before at that time, because people were either taking ribbons down or moving ribbons or whatever. So we marked it the night before. And so he took them out on the trail. I was the mobile aid station driving from spot to spot. And he started thinking about it. And I should put a marathon with it, because I think, remember, it was the first year I worked the aid station, that Mark had started a 25-miler at the same time the Voyager started. And they finished at the zoo, and they were very upset that they didn't get all the perks that the 50-milers got. So Mark didn't do that anymore. But, yeah, so that's how the half Voyager marathon started. He had this bright idea. He was going to have them optional loop. And I said, well, how are you going to, you know, make sure who does which? So yep. I'm not involved in that. So it became a marathon.
Yeah. So were you and Gene Duluth natives, or where do you come from? How did you end up in Duluth?
We met in high school at Duluth Central, the old building.
Cool. And so 84, that was the first, that's kind of your introduction to the running world.
Right.
Your husband, Gene, saw it, wanted to do it, and it kind of snowballs. What was the running world like those first few years? I mean, Grandma's was kind of gaining steam, I think, right?
Yeah, I walked it two or three times, and there were between 4,000 and 4,500 people.
Yeah.
And that was it. And say that 1 year, well, when we got involved with the NMTC, I think the most people we ever had was maybe 30. And for the tougher ones, we had 10, 12.
Yeah.
And every woman that ran it was in the newspaper, because we never got more than five.
Well, that's interesting. So they're posting even the NMTC runs in the newspaper for results, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Well, Kevin Pates, who was the reporter who did golf and running, and he was a runner, very small man, fast, short distance runner, and he was fascinated with Voyager. He, Jarl asked him one time, would you run it? You get dirty. And I swear his running shorts had creases. But he would call me like Thursday to put a little pre-race thing on Friday, and who was signed up and how many, and who were the favorites and so on.
Yeah.
Every year he did that. So.
And now these days we're less reliant on the newspaper, because there's the online results.
Right.
And all
the
that.
First year I was in charge of Voyager, I had a box with index cards with names, the numbers, and the places they came from on the front. And then I put every split, because we took splits all the way across at that time, and I actually sent all a big spreadsheet with all the splits, which was cut and paste literally. <At that time>. Commodore 64.
And what year was that, Barb, when you started?
91.
91, okay.
Yeah, it was the 10th annual Voyager.
10th annual.
And there were 500 or 600 milers in the country. Western, Leadville, Wasatch, the one in Virginia, and Vermont. And then Angeles Crest came, and Gene wanted to do 100, and my mother lived out by Angeles Crest and his sister, so he was going to do that. And then Harry decided to start the Superior 100. And he's telling me at the Snowshoe Marathon post race thing, yeah, and I'm going to need some help. And he's looking at me, and I told him, There's Tammy. She's the one that got me stuck organizing the aid stations for the Edmonds. So he and Tammy. I ended up working an aid station and, of course, crewing for Eugene. He dragged my son to the first one. And Bill had been running Voyager with him and Ice Age mm-hmm. and a bunch of other stuff like that. In fact, he ran a bunch of 50s before he ever ran a marathon. And he told his dad, we're going to do this once. I'm only going to do it once. You better get me through. And he did, and Bill only did it once. He was a lot smarter than his dad. Gene was the first one to do 10 of them.
Wow.
So 91, yeah, that's when you started taking over Voyager, and was the first year of Superior 100, right?
Yes.
Were you and Gene involved in helping with that, or was that kind of just Tammy?
Oh, yeah. Well, Barb, my youngest future wife, and let's see, I worked an aid station. Gene took both boys the year before I took over, or no, 2 years before I took over. And we were an aid, Grand Portage aid station, actually. And so it was really hot the year before. That was the first year he took Bill with him on that one. And Jarl's in-laws at the time, the Beasleys, were in charge of the aid station. They were getting balled out by runners. It was hot. Their drinks were warm. There were hornets around. So Gene says, look at my dad's tent, screen tent, and you can run the aid station. Huh? And the screen tent kept a little of the rain out, but not a lot of it.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Yeah, it's about the most depressive time of year, I think, for Voyager. I mean, it's hot, it's buggy.
I think Bill was trying to kill Jarl with that race. That's why it had such bizarre trail. Well, we don't have Gogebic Street. We don't have Jarl's Beach. It was before Gene ran it. It started at the zoo, ran up to where the bridge is across now, where they come out onto the Munger, and turned around and went back. And so, and that was only 48 miles. So, of course, Jarl decided, if we're going to make it a 50, we're going to make it a 50.
And so I was gonna ask
Barb, have you had a chance, or do you get out to the Voyager much anymore and just kind of hang out? And
the last couple of years I haven't. I was doing Leola's 5K. I could never do it before because I was packet pickup, but right. And then, you know, hanging out and meeting. But the last time I even looked results up was a couple years ago. And what is it? There's 300 people now, and I don't think I even know 30 of them anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
All the runners I know are either not running anymore, and some of them have died. Which is sad, but there it is. They're old. Like.
And it was interesting. I actually saw with my own two eyes the Voyager record be broken, I think in 2018, and that was after many, many attempts on Scott Jurek's long
record. Roger Peccary held it for 11 years before Scott and Jarro broke it. They actually, it was, they were less than 5 minutes apart at every aid station.
Yeah.
Scott told Kevin, the newspaper guy, when he was done, he'd never run a 50-mile sprint before. And I guess in the last 3 miles, one of them fell. I don't remember which, but I heard the story later. And the other one helped him up. They knew they were going to break the record and decided to do it together. Well, Jarl was a minute and a half about behind Scott. And he came up to me and he said, something happened to me at 48 miles. I'm probably only 48 miles. they ran like maniacs.
Yeah.
And of course, that was his fifth Voyager. The first time he ran, he came up at a little race in Wisconsin the September before, and Dusty had won that year, his buddy. And he'd run lots of the course with Dusty training. And he came up and introduced himself. And I'm looking at fresh faced. He was 19 then, probably. He was 20 when he did the race first time. I was thinking, I don't know if he's going to do real well. Well, Jaro decided, with Dusty winning that race, who had very little focus, and nobody could believe he won 50-mile race.
Yeah.
And so Jaro was coming back to show him how it's really done. Well, the first year, Scott was second to Jaro, and Dusty was behind Scott. The second year, Charlie Hubbard, who was a good triathlete, who gave up swimming when his first child was born, gave up biking when his second child was born. He should have had a third child. He actually destroyed himself running, so he couldn't run anymore. But yeah, he was running well at that time, and he beat Scott. And of course, the next 3 years, Scott won.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I guess I've read, you know, Eat and Run and heard the Scott Jurek story, but what was it like seeing kind of this fresh-faced 19-year-old, and then a few years later, he's on the, you know, cover of the magazines, and
I mean,
what was that?
Well, like? I know Mark Dorian, who used to write for Ultra Running and actually was on the board picking the greatest ultra runner of the year. He lobbied for Scott's breaking of the record to be the greatest. So he was trying to get him on the cover before. But yeah, I say he was a good kid. Grandpa used to crew for him, and he'd always ask me when he picked up his packet if I had an extra shirt for Grandpa, and I always have to tell him, because I didn't want to short any real runners, you know, and tell him to call me after. And so I ended up giving him an extra shirt every year. He'd either stop out or we'd stop over, because he didn't live all that far from us. And nice kid. He always come, whenever I saw him, he'd come up and give me a big hug. We went out to Boulder City. I think Gene I don't remember how long the race was. Gene did the shorter of the two, and Scott was out there. He was glad to see us.
That's cool. Yeah. You bring up another name too that I've seen his name all over the place, and Roger Peccary.
He won the first six Voyagers.
Yeah, he used to just dominate that, and clearly he was very fast.
There's a good story about him. He was a skier.
Okay.
Scott was a skier.
Yes.
And he paid Bill half the entry fee for the first Voyager, because he was only going to run halfway. I got the story from Bob Hartle, who was his crew at that time. And at that time, it started at the zoo and turned around. And so Bob was waiting there, and Frank Bozanich, who was a internationally known ultra runner at that time, had come up to do it. And Roger was only going to do half, so he ran like a maniac. And he felt so bad when he got to the turnaround for practically using Frank up that he decided to do the whole thing. So Bob Hartle's waiting and waiting and waiting, and he's already gone. Whether he ever paid Bill the other half, I don't know. And then Jaro finally won the race the seventh, because he was race director that year. I don't know if there was a correlation there or not. But yeah, he actually, the year that Mark put in the 25-mile, Roger came back and ran it, and we were at the Grand Portage aid station about 10 miles in, and all these other runners are saying, he's going way too fast. No, that's Roger Perry. He wanted to, his home race was Pavel Nurmi in Wisconsin. Uh-huh. He wanted to concentrate on that. It was only a couple of weeks after Voyager. So that's why after six wins, he said. And the last year, Jarro was right behind him, but it was finishing up at the other school, Carlton. And there were train tracks right before the entrance, the end to the school, and Jarro got stuck waiting for a train. He said, you're about 7 hours that year, but.
That's funny. It's interesting to think about, you know, just it's always kind of this little world, you know, of runners and
yes.
Runners come and go. And I think a theme that we always try and hit on the Duluth Rundown is kind of mentors. And I guess thinking back to when your husband Gene kind of saw grandmas, I mean, did you and Gene have friends that were runners, or did you kind of just slide
into the kids were in school. Gene at that time played racquetball. Billy was working down there, and of course Harry Sloan was played racquetball down there. And then he'd go out for a smoke. But I know Gene, while he was running, would bring up any questions he had to anybody that was around. He talked his way through most of the races. And he, of course, he and Billy, my oldest, ran together a lot. And Brian Popple, whose wife took over the Superior after Harry got done, had fallen in Voyager and cracked a couple of ribs. And he did not want to slow down, and he couldn't speed up, so he was running right about the same pace as Gene and Billy. And he got up to Darlene, his wife, and says, don't they ever stop talking? And she said, no.
Let's talk a little bit about the NMTC races and kind of getting those going. So you were involved mostly early on with the fall series.
No, with the spring series.
With the spring series, I'm sorry, that is right. The spring series first, and then the fall series got going second.
No, actually, we weren't involved until a little bit. Well, I wasn't involved. Gene used to run them. And then I think the first, I ended up picking up the trail at Hartley. And Jarro had, of course, marked it. And he put the ribbons so high up, I had to jump for him. And every time he did that, there was a puddle right under. I think it was a ploy to get me to buy shoes. I'm not sure. But there were all of these signs. I'm carrying an armful of signs trying to get to it. Gene's, of course, at the finish line talking away. And he was going to come back and help me. Well, I finally said, I've had enough of these signs. Put them down. And I said, the signs are back there. And he finally
nice.
That was my introduction to working races. And I kept doing it. I don't know.
Yeah, just kept saying yes until you started being the head honcho.
Yes. Well, Mark DeLorme, who had taken it over the last 2 years before I took over, I say I was in charge of aid stations the year before. That's how I ended up in charge of the Ed Fitz aid stations, I think. And he wanted to run the race. And, of course, all the other guys who had been race directors did too. And
yeah,
I was kind of curious to see if I could do the logistics. And I drove into the finish line because I was checking out the aid stations and making sure everything was good till they closed. And I come into the finish line and everybody stands up and starts cheering. They must have told everybody that I was going to take over, which I hadn't decided yet. The first year I had it, Les Honstad, who was part of the ALARC group out of the cities, talked, I don't know how many, I think 40 some people into running Voyager, telling them it was easy, it was fun. They should have had a clue that Les wasn't running it. I don't think if any of them could have stood up, they would have killed him when it was over. But we had 140 people sign up that year. And then the next year it was like 84, and it was small for a couple of years. And I think 140 was the most I ever had. But I was up through 2005, which was the last year I had it. I was a sucker for punishment. 16 years. I finally told a few people, if nobody takes it, I'm taking it with me. I'm done. And Janet Evenson and Cheryl Leslie, who was the ham organizer when we finally got hams again. And Janet and Cheryl volunteered Raleigh Everson to take over, and he had it for 2-3 years and then got transferred for work. And that's when Mark took over. So
what sort of changes have you seen in the Duluth running community?
Enormously grown.
Yeah,
there was a running boom after Frank Shorter won the Olympic marathon, and then it died back pretty much. And it's a huge boom now. Although what's going on with every, although there's a ton of runners out today.
And I'm curious too, what you've seen, Barb, with just the kind of the perception or the acceptance of trail running through the years, because obviously right now Duluth is, I think, really well known for its, I think, just many, many miles of trails and the high quality of trails and kind of the standards of trail building that, you know, we've adopted, and the city kind of being responsive on shutting down the trails if it's too muddy, and kind of differences between, you know, today's trails or even in 2005 when you started phasing out and when you started in, you know, the 80s and 90s.
Okay, Bill, when he started the NMTC, you couldn't advertise because he had no permits and no insurance. It was word of mouth. That's the way it went.
Nice.
Very loose. And a lot of the ultras were actually serve yourself. They would put water out under little tarps or whatever, and that's what you did. And now people expect, you know, the full gamut like they do in, you know, the big road marathons. But that's changed, quite a bit. I'm going to say it was very loose early on. We had tons of dogs running everything else.
And almost like from a trail work perspective, I mean, was there a lot of time spent around the races themselves, like maintaining the trails or cutting back brush, or I mean, were these just
Jarro always bugged Gene because the half was 2 weeks before the full. He wanted it to be 3 weeks so everybody could run both. And Gene absolutely refused to cut it more than once. And he only would cut Jarro's Beach every other year. That's why it was every other year.
Oh,
funny. But yeah, he spent hours. The grass around my yard was about a foot tall because he was off mowing trails instead. And
wow.
One of our good friends who had lived in the cities for years had moved up just off of Peterson's on the other side of Palki Road, and he did a lot of the cutting as well. And of course, then Gene would get limes every year. For some reason, Ed never got limes, but they were both out there cutting all the time.
Yeah.
And he had a small group of loyal people helping cut and marking stuff. Randy Back, I don't know if he's still running or not, but he was one that helped a lot. And the year Jarro and Scott broke the record, I think it was, they had to go out. Well, Gene was 5'6", and he cut enough, you know, high enough to get through himself. And maybe 5'8". So they went out and clipped all the things they would have hit their heads on.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe tall enough, maybe not for Jarro, though, huh?
No, he's a pretty tall kid.
Well, I've had the opportunity, Barb, to read a lot of the old NMTC newsletters.
Uh-huh.
Which were really fun to read. I'm really curious about some of the old races that aren't taking place anymore. There were some old NMTC races that kind of had short lives. Those are really fascinating to me.
Well, I know one of the first ones I went out with Gene to mark, we were supposed to go a certain way. And there was a big fence with private property on it. So that was one of the big things. And Rolling Stone, that we still have, would have normally finished in McDonald's. So a lot of it is the trails are gone.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like neighborhoods have popped up into where there used to be just woods, and now it's all houses.
Right.
So the trails have completely disappeared. The one that I'm thinking of, I think is like that is the Blackman race potentially. There's a neighborhood there now that I feel like has probably taken over some of the trails that were there.
Right. But,
yeah. So that's up off Arrowhead Road.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, it's changed, no doubt about it. I mean, it's, of course, with 100, 150 people, it's a whole lot different than when you had a group of 10 or 12 or even 20.
Yeah, exactly. That makes things completely, the necessity for change becomes apparent as well at times.
Yes, yes. I know a Voyager we had, Minnesota Power. They messed us up several times. They were one of the main sponsors. Mark DeLorme worked for them. Don Fennessy, who was our safety and back guy for years, worked for them. And they were going to sell this little corner. It's part of Jay Cook's Triangle Trail. And Jay Cook was supposed to have first bid on it. Well, there were a couple of hikers out. This was before Voyager. And some guy comes out with a gun and says, this is his property. And that's the first they knew it had been sold. So Gene had to dig a ditch kind of around this fence. Wow. I remember one guy was yelling at him, what did you do that for? Well, it's either that or get shot.
Wow.
Okay. And then one year, I think Doug Happy had marked that section after 7 o'clock at night on Friday. And I came down from Jay Cook following the early runners to turn up Jay Cook Road. And here, I think it was Bob Frawley and Roger Dupay, a couple of the old hands at Voyager, walking up Jay Cook Road. What the heck? Well, Don knew nothing about it. He worked for Minnesota Power. They had drained Forbay Lake and wouldn't let anybody run that way. Luckily, Gary and Kenny were out there on their bikes just checking the race and moved everybody down on the 210 and up Jacob Road to get past the section. Yeah, they messed us up a few times.
Oh, yeah. What a... Do you have a favorite NMTC course, Barb?
I don't think I do. The ones closer to the road where I didn't have to sit out in the woods helped, because I was the finish line. I remember one year we were going to do Rough Rider, and I was sitting at the little parking spot off Beck's Road in the car pouring rain. And Jarl actually came up to me and said, why don't you stay in the car? Because they knew to look for me where that was where the finish line was.
Yeah.
So they had to run up that road. I was thankful. I was surprised Jarl would allow it. He was very picky about where horses went. If we did find a new course for some reason or other, we'd send him out. How far was that one? He always knew.
What about other weather kind of issues? I mean, do you have any stories of particular weather events as you were volunteering for races and
The 15 mile that went out from Spirit Mountain to Beck's Road and back, Gene had everybody gathered, all the cars were parked beside the road, and he's ready to say go. Lightning hit about 20 yards off the trail. Ooh. And I turned around and everyone was sitting in their car. Most of them, Eugene could care less. Most of them went out, and then it started to hail.
Oh, no.
Most of them finished. There were a few that wouldn't get out of the car.
There's been a few lightning delays. I know. I can remember once at Point Pine, down on Park Point, there was a lightning storm and got postponed. And yeah.
He did wait 5 minutes before he sent them out, and then we had a big lightning storm, and people were going across the power lines at that time. As Gene pointed out, if we stopped everybody at the end of the power lines, it would be this big group to get hit. And it had stopped by the time half the people got through the power lines. And there were a few that wouldn't go, but and it was done. I mean, the year Gene didn't do Superior, the first year he didn't do Superior, he'd been playing racquetball and moved sideways, and he went up to the start all dressed to run with his number on. It was the sixth annual, and he's walking like a little old man. Harry took one look at him, took his number off, said, we need the pins. Gene didn't even complain, but that was the first year he didn't do it, and it was lightning something awful. I remember one of our friends who came up from Wisconsin crawled across Moose Mountain. The lightning was so bad. Another one looked for somebody taller to run with him. But you know, what can you do? There are people scattered all over everywhere.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
How do you communicate to everyone? I mean, you have to wait till they come into an aid station.
Exactly. And I say for Voyager that year, by the time they got to the aid station, it was done. But it was just that very hairy few minutes where it was lightning like crazy. And when Mark had hams. Well, when I took over, the hams had split into two factions, and the one whose tower they were using took it down. So I had no hams the first 2 years, which, and then we got this kid, Kevin, he's Barb's mailman, but he wasn't even old enough to drive, and he was a ham operator, and he got together, I think, two other people, and we managed to cover most of the course. A couple years later, Cheryl Leslie volunteered to coordinate the hams, and by then the tower had gone back up, thank goodness. So it was really nice knowing who was out there and who wasn't.
Funny. I want to know, Barb, runners and ultra marathoners who, you know, see Superior and see Voyager and think, that's cool, I want to do it. You know, what advice do you have from them, or what do you think new runners should know about kind of the history of ultra running and trail running in Duluth, and you know, some tips or just like pieces, tidbits of knowledge, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what my crazy husband told anybody that called and asked if the half at Kernow now was a good first marathon. He always told them yes. And then they'd get done and start screaming at him, and he'd say, well, any other one you do after that's going to be easy. We had three guys come up from Baton Rouge, Louisiana one year to do the half. And one stopped at the top of the power lines, held onto the grass, and said, I'm not going. Another, so he started running because he knew it was the only way to get down, tripped, went flying over a guy who was crawling down. And then this kid from Kentucky who became a very good ultra runner, and he was a fast marathoner before, like 2.5 hour, and he came up and he got to he won it, and we're Jarrow and I are standing there, who is that? We don't recognize him. I don't remember his name now, but he was very good, and he wound up winning a few others. But he came into the finish, took one look at Eugene, and said, next time somebody from Minnesota says it's a hard trail, I'll believe him. But yeah, my advice would be to kind of look at the trail first.
That's smart.
I know a few people came from California the first year we had the Superior 100. And they're used to switchbacks on their hills instead of just straight up and down. I think it was an interesting experience. I know Susie Gimble came back next year, and somebody asked her, well, how'd the race go? I only fell half as often. And then Mickey Rollins, who was a race director, he did was Rocky Raccoon group of races down in Texas, and we were in the same motel and at Ice Age, and he said he was coming back to do Voyager while I was putting up pictures after most of the people had finished. And Mickey comes up to me and he looks at me, Bob, you can take those power lines and flatten them. But yeah, there are people who were working aid stations for years and had no clue what was out there. I know there were, you know, when we started the half, a lot of runners and aid people did it just to see what the trail was like, and the runners would bring their significant others with them, show them what they were doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, when somebody from Minnesota tells you it's a hard trail, you got to believe them.
That's good to know. I think that advice holds true today as ever, for sure.
Yes. It's the first Superior had maybe 50 people in it, I think. And so it was, things were a lot smaller then.
Right. It's wild. There's not much popularity.
There's an interesting, I think it was the first year of the Superior 100. I was working the Highway 1 aid station and then went to crew for Eugene, but we heard all these rumors about a guy breaking his leg out there. And of course, panic. Well, he had an artificial leg. And he broke the artificial leg. His crew came back in on the trail. He was doing well. And they brought his swimming leg. So they had to bring it back out. And then Harry said, he gave it to the skier to bring in since he was all hiking back and forth. And so the skier put the leg in his backpack, and he sees this guy sitting, and he says, how you doing? He says, have you got an extra leg? Yeah. Well, the skier was Scott Jurek.
Oh,
He wasn't famous then.
That's great. Well, Mike, do you have any other questions or anything for Barb?
I was just going to ask you the same thing, Tony. No.
Yeah, I don't think I do.
Well, talking about road ultras, I did fans for 20 years. And one year, well, it was the second or third year, it was pouring rain. We were going around Lake Harriet at that time. And the lightning was hitting the lake, ankle deep in rain. They had to call it for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Pause.
Another year, we're getting ready to go down there from Barb's house. She was living in Isani at the time. And listening to the radio, and it was already 85 degrees at 5:30 in the morning, and the race started at 8. So that was the first year I won the walk, though. Nobody else backed off. All I said was, I think I'm going to see if I can actually walk for 24 hours.
Wow.
It wasn't, it was about 100K, but.
Not bad. Yeah, that's pretty good. So, well, Barb, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We really appreciate these. These are some great stories. For sure. And also, yeah. I want to thank you for all the work that you put in over the years.
Well, yeah, it was fun. We met a lot of nice people. Ultra runners were a really nice group, that's for sure. And trail runners, pretty much the same group.
Yeah.
Go out there and meet all our friends.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us for episode number 28 of the Duluth Rundown podcast. Big thanks to Barb Kernow for our interview section. Really fun to hear some of her stories, and I feel like we just kind of scratched the surface on a lot of the stories, but it was just awesome to hear from her and some of the things that she's witnessed and participated in here in the Duluth running world. Again, big thank you to our sponsor, Austin Jarrow, for supporting this episode. And Mike, what else you got to say?
Well, I just wanted to kind of point out how, you know, everyone who's in the running kind of community now and doing races or using the trails, I really hope that Barb's story is inspirational to inspire people to get out and volunteer their time. You know, that's what I think keeps the community strong. And, you know, without Barb's efforts, for one, I don't think we'd have such a vibrant trail community and race community here in Duluth today. So really cool to see and to see some of the history. And, you know, a theme of our podcast is kind of that we're linking the chain. And so I think hopefully with this podcast, we can kind of link, you know, the history of Barb and the Kernows and kind of the world, you know, back in the 80s and 90s to, you know, the running world today and keep passing that kind of concept of stewardship on. So I think it's important and fun to hear. So.
Yeah, well said. I couldn't agree with you more on that.
Yeah, so I guess that's a wrap on episode 28, and we'll see you next time.